Big news! This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. From choosing the right travel card to dodging hidden fees, Smart Travel helps your money go further, literally. They cover all things travel finance, like which flight deals are actually deals and which are clickbait. They'll also tell you when to skip the bundle and book separately. Plus, how to avoid paying for upgrades that you won't use. Travel smarter and spend less with help from NerdWallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
Welcome to the Fromer Travel Show. I'm your host, Pauline Fromer. My colleague Jason is here to share an epic adventure with all of us. In fact, he just returned from what is arguably the most talked about, most anticipated new tourist attraction on the planet. Hey, Jason, welcome back to the Fromer Travel Show.
Hello, Pauline.
So am I exaggerating as usual, or is this a way to introduce where you just were?
I think that what you just said is fair. Epic Universe is what we're going to be talking about in Orlando. And it's a park that Universal Orlando, owned by Comcast, has been working on feverishly throughout COVID for years at a reported cost of $7 billion.
Wow.
The third dry theme park they have in Orlando. They also have a water park, which means they have now four theme parks in Orlando. They are ready to get people to come for multi-day vacations, and they're going after Disney. And their brand new park opened on May 22nd after much, much synergy from its corporate cousin, NBC.
And it's not just a big deal for Universal. This is the first major theme park in Orlando to open in a decade, right?
More than that. The last fully formed theme park to open in Orlando was in 1999. So, 26 years ago, but it was also by Universal. So Universal's been setting the pace lately. It's a giant theme park by most standards. It's about as big as the Magic Kingdom, which of course is the most visited theme park in not only Orlando, but also in the world, which is owned by Disney.
And speaking of Disney, over the years, Universal has gotten a lot of Disney Imagineers to join its team, right?
Yeah.
Did you see that, strategy coming to fruition at this new park?
Yeah, you're obviously not going to see Mickey Mouse, but you are seeing a very, very intense design directive. It is very clear that Universal not only really put in the time and the talent, but also the money. This thing it's what they call themed, which is, basically means decor. It is themed everywhere. The every surface you see, every dish you order, it has all gone through the design process to make it sort of what they call immersive, to give you a really feeling that you're part of whatever the story of the place that you're in is about. The way it's set up here, how Disneyland is set up in different lands. There's a Frontierland, there's a Tomorrowland. Well, the conceit of this theme park is worlds. There are four major worlds which are connected with the, franchises that you're familiar with. One is a Harry Potter themed world that is set in sort of like a 1920s Paris, like its Fantastic Beasts spinoff. There's another world that's themed to How to Train Your Dragon, which is a popular animated and now live action movie that they put out. There's one themed to Nintendo, which all the millennials out there will be very familiar with the characters and the colors there. And there's one themed to the classic movie monsters of Universal Pictures from the 1930s. So we're talking, Frankenstein and the werewolf and Dracula. And then this is all bound together by one sort of newly created vague land called Celestial Park, which sort of, it's sort of like the center of everything where you can go from one to the other through this other area. But each of these places is incredibly detailed. It really feels like, for example, when you're in the Harry Potter section, you really feel like you're walking in city streets in Paris, the full-scale buildings with the mansard roofs and the alleys you can go into. and the cafes that spill out onto the street. It's really remarkable.
Well, I loved the photos you put up on Instagram, and you were talking about how detailed it was. Even the signs for the bathroom have art on them that kind of go with the theming, right?
Yeah, everywhere you look, it's what they call detail. For example, the stroller parking in Dark Universe, which is the movie monster section, has a like kind of an engraving of an old-fashioned baby carriage with a claw coming out of the carriage as if your baby is turned into a creature. And it's like that everywhere. Nothing is phoned in. It must have been, like, it was $7 billion in the press. Who knows if it cost even more. And the rides, there's 9 major rides, which it seems a little on the small side, but it is pretty much in line with any brand new theme park. That's about what a brand new theme park will have. They'll add more in time. But the rides are extremely technically complicated and trying new ride systems that have never been tried before. The biggest, most elaborate ride is the Harry Potter ride. And essentially, you're seated, but you're essentially riding in an elevator that goes up, left, down, right, and goes speeding through space through enormous cavernous areas where battles are happening in front of you between Dolores Umbridge, who's the great villain from the Harry Potter movies, and your favorite characters from Harry Potter. And it's so that you can't even figure out what's real and what's on screen and what's a robot. It's absolutely remarkable what they've been able to do. But it's so popular that on its first day of full operation, there was a 300-minute wait for this ride because technologically it's so complicated. So I'm recommending to people that if they do want to go to this theme park, they probably wait a few months so that some of the intense interest dies down a little bit, but also so the kinks are worked out because these are brand new ride systems that have never been tried before with a lot of robotics.
So the 300-minute wait had to do with the ride stopping because of mechanical issues?
A little bit of that, but also a lot because everyone wants to go to that one. They've heard that it's this incredible new system, and they basically flock to that ride first. So the other rides would have a half an hour wait, and that one would be hours. And of course, the queue, which of course is the word for a line when you're in a theme park, is so ornate and beautiful. They've done it so that if you've seen the Harry Potter movies, when you're at the Ministry of Magic, you kind of travel through like a flu system, and you end up in this great ornate hall where people are busy at work. It's like being a city inside a building. Well, they've recreated it almost verbatim from the movies, and people are just going inside to gawk at how massive this new area is. And they've had to even create a system whereas if you don't want to ride the ride, you can still go in and admire what they've built for the queue. So it's gotten to the point where just the area where you wait in line has become a tourist attraction along with the rides themselves. And I'm all for it because in the United States, a lot of the theme parks have been cutting the corners, including Disney, not building with anything close to this level of detail. So it's really kind of great to see the artistry and the expense going into it.
Well, and it also must be good climate-wise because it gets damn hot in Florida. You said it was like 95 when you were down there exploring all this and humid.
Well, a lot of the outside lines are outside. So, you know, that's not every line is going to be inside. So unfortunately, that's part of it. So if you don't like heat, you got to wait till Florida gets a little cooler.
Right.
Another problem with brand new theme parks is the trees have yet to grow in. So yeah, that is a consideration when you go to, but if you go in the wintertime, obviously that won't be an issue.
Okay. So before we leave Harry Potter World, I'm sure there's some cynics among our listeners thinking, well, I've been to the other Harry Potter theme parks. Why do I want to shovel over a hell of a lot of money, and it always is a lot of money nowadays in Orlando, to go to another Harry Potter attraction? You said this is in Paris, so I guess that's different. What else is different about this one?
Yeah, there's no other Harry Potter world that is like this. What Universal has done with the Harry Potter concept is create sort of like chapters in a book. There's the chapter that's Hogsmeade, which is the village that's outside of Hogwarts. There's the chapter at Diagon Alley, which is where you get your provisions if you're a wizard. And now there's this one in Paris. And each one is in a separate theme park. So if you want to do all the different Harry Potter worlds, you have to go to 3 different theme parks and pay each time. It's diabolical, but it's working. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Epic Universe, they not only have this incredible ride with this amazing ride system, there's also a show that's really technologically advanced called Circus Arcanoe, which is done in the middle of the land. So there's a couple more things to do that you won't be able to do at any other theme park. If you're into Harry Potter and you want to collect all the wands and have the different varieties of butter beer. For example, there are butter beer crepes because it's Paris. Oh, then, you know, you're going to want to go. There are not many diehard Harry Potter fans who would scoff at spending $150 to $180 to get into Epic Universe, which is the going rate for a theme park these days in Orlando. Just a few years ago, we were amazed that they cost $100, and now they've sped way past that.
So I got to ask, did you try the butterbeer crepes? How is the food in Harry Potter world?
The food actually was quite good. They've got croque monsieur's, you know, not a French bistro type food. Everything leans a little sweet for my taste in Orlando, I'll be honest. You know, butterbeer already is one of the sweetest concoctions you could try. It's sort of like a butterscotch lifesavers in a Coke form. But, you know, and the butterbeer crepes are no different from that. But, you know, it's fun if you want to try all the, it's not only the Harry Potter food that's interesting. In Dark Universe, there are burgers that are, it's called Das Steakhouse. And there's sort of there's like blood red buns and like, it's sort of themed to monsters. And there's a garlic steak, which is basically like a like garlic knot, but it looks like a steak you would drive through a vampire's heart. It's a lot of fun. Everything has been thought of. In the Donkey Kong area of the Nintendo Land, there is this, it's like a pineapple soft serve with caramel corn sundae. And they serve it in a special barrel shaped Donkey Kong mug. It costs $19, and there's always a huge line because nowadays theme parks know that it's not just about the rides. People are taking Instagram pictures or TikTok videos of the things they're eating and buying. So now even the food is elaborate so that people are taking pictures of all the different things there are to eat. And pretty much every single menu and every restaurant, and there's about a dozen restaurants, some of them are walk up and some of them are sit down, have really beautiful thought through food that people want to post pictures of. So you get a little more bang for your buck that way, at least.
So I'm getting the feeling from speaking to you that Harry Potter, this new Harry Potter world, is the pinnacle of this park. Is that the case? Or does it get competition from, say, the classic movie monsters section or Nintendo?
Obviously, it depends who you ask. I think most of the people I talk to talk about three other major highlights. One, there's a double roller coaster. The two are dispatched at the same time and they race each other and they intertwine in very interesting ways. There, people are calling one of the best roller coasters out there. It's called Stardust Racers. And it's beautiful, especially at night. They're careful not to illuminate it. Just the cars themselves light up. So it feels like you're on a comet. That's what they want you to feel like. You've hitched a ride to a comet. But it is one of the most thrilling, intense, inversion-packed airtime roller coasters that has ever been built, certainly in Orlando. And roller coaster fans that's in Celestial Park, right near the entrance of Harry Potter. People also love the land of the How to Train Your Dragon, which is called Isle of Berk. And people prefer that in some cases to the Harry Potter land because it's so whimsically decorated. It's sort of like an interesting ramshackle sort of Viking village that looks very much like the animated cartoon. And people love the lighting and just how wild and weird and wooden it all feels. So people kind of prefer that land in terms of atmosphere. But the ride called Monsters Unchained, which is over in the Dark Universe movie monsters section, is the ride that more of the aficionados seem to be favoring. And it's sort of like we sit on a bench, and then the bench sort of is at the end of a robot arm. And this is not a spoiler. You learn this very early. And the robot arm sort of swings your bench around, and sometimes you're leaning back and sometimes you're leaning forward as movie monsters, most of them robots, sort of spring out at you as you go along the way. So at one point, the creature from the Black Lagoon wants to get you. Frankenstein is near you, and Dracula is levitating ahead of you. And it's so technologically advanced, and the robots are so lifelike that some people are saying that that's actually the sleeper hit ride of the bunch. I got a little nauseated on the Harry Potter thing. I wasn't crazy about the movements. Most other people didn't feel that way. But everyone I know who's ridden the Monsters Unchained ride says, wow, that's an achievement because of all the many robotics.
That's so interesting because I was wondering when I heard about this Monsters area, do people care enough about Frankenstein still and the classic movies like Dracula and the werewolf and all of that? That seems so far in the past for this generation.
But if you don't know much about theme parks these days, you might be surprised to know that Halloween has become one of their biggest seasons. A lot of the major theme parks now have special theme parks within a theme park of haunted houses, maybe six or eight. They build brand new from scratch every single year. And they pack the place with extra people paying an extra ticket price. every night for the entire season from like August to October. So Halloween has become a huge thing for them. And so the monsters fit right in. And I know a lot of people who go to theme parks regularly who are really the most excited that Universal was finally using its back catalog of movie monsters in a way that Disney would like to, you know, use its princesses. It's like about time Universal used this IP. And in theme park world, IP, it means intellectual property. So, you know, things have changed. Halloween is such a big seller now that the Dark Universe area is one of the more popular ones.
So they've got that whack, incredible ride where these monsters jump out at you at Dark Universe. What else is there? Do you see, I don't know, Dracula's castle?
Frankenstein, Dr. Frankenstein. It is no longer belonged to the man you see, Colin Clive played him in the 30s. It's now his great-granddaughter, Victoria. She is now the mad scientist who wants to redeem the name of Frankenstein. So we have she seems like she might be liberated, but she's just as insane as her great-great-grandfather. Tries to reanimate Dracula using Frankenstein technology. Not a great idea. That's why the ride goes so wrong. So there's more to do. There's also a roller coaster, a little cute thing. You can get your face done with monster makeup. It's a little bit tongue-in-cheek so that it's not going to necessarily terrify your kid if they've been around and seen a PG or R movie. So there's a lot more fun to do, and there's a lot more fun food too. A lot of the food is themed near the Frankenstein castle. There's a windmill. Then every 10 minutes or so, the windmill's blades will spin and they all catch fire. And it's called the Burning Blade Tavern. And everyone gathers around to wait for the moment the blades start to spin and catch on fire. So there's more to do, more Instagram moments all over the place.
Wow. Okay. So I feel like we've given a good attention to Harry Potter world, to the monster world, Nintendo. That's not my generation. I
was an Atari guy. I'm that old. So I'm like an 8-bit person, but Nintendo kind of falls in that like 20 years ago, 25 years ago.
Yeah.
So Mario Kart. There's a ride where you put on a helmet, and in the visor that you attach when you're in this ride, there's projections of video game characters that you sort of have to fire at using buttons on the cart you're riding. So only you can see the game that's happening in your visor, but it's happening in a room that everyone else is also in as they travel through. So you see lots of different things. If you take off the visor, the same things everyone else does, but then you see the game on your own. It's a lot. It's fun. It's very well executed. There's a Donkey Kong minecart ride.
Wait, before you leave that one. So you have the visor on, you see other things happening. Are the other things what your fellow riders are shooting at?
No, you're playing your own game. You're trying to shoot turtle shells at the villains and not hit your friends. Your friends, of course, are projected inside. If you play Mario Kart, you know there's a list of your friends and there's a list of your villains. And you're familiar with these characters already, so you kind of know who to go for. If you don't know any of these characters, you're shooting your turtle shells at the wrong people and you're doing the wrong thing all the time. But it's still fun. And it's a slow-moving ride, so it's not going to make you... you're not going to go upside down or anything like that. But if you've ever played Mario Kart, it's probably the best incarnation of that ride that you could probably have wished for. And it takes place in a giant castle, and the line itself too, which is indoors, is a lot of fun to explore. It's extremely well done. But Nintendo, Super Nintendo World is the whole name of the area, is... if you've ever played Super Mario Brothers, it's a bright green, lots of characters moving, lots of mechanical things twisting and turning and spinning and moving all around you. It's like having a fever dream because everything's in motion all around you, and it's nothing. You can't know where to look. It's absolutely a stunning, beautiful visual achievement. That's what the main appeal of Super Nintendo World is, just how eye-popping everything is all around you. It feels like you have stepped into the game you used to play, in your bedroom when you were in seventh grade.
Wow. And Italian food? Is that, is there pizza? Is there pasta or not so much?
It's called Pizza Moon, I sound like I'm selling this place. I do suspect that they have more restaurants than they're going to be able to use. This always happens with theme parks. They run for a year or two and they realize, we have a couple more restaurants than people are coming to. We can close them down. So now's a good time to go to take everything in because everything is running full tilt before they make their adjustments.
Interesting. Okay, so we've covered Nintendo. We've covered Harry Potter. We've covered the monsters. And you said a bit about How to Train Your Dragon, that it's just very whimsical in the look. Whimsical in what way?
It's again brightly colored, lots of mechanical dragons popping out of holes in the roofs. And you know, there's a roller coaster, that kind of a swoopy, fast moving thing that's very pleasant to ride that goes throughout the entire land. So there's always some visual appeal. There's a slow moving boat ride where your goal is to hit targets with your water cannon. But of course, you also sometimes will hit other people and other boats on purpose. So you get soaked. That's called fire drill. And there's this kind of a simple glider ride where you're at the end of a long, you'll see pictures of it, but you're at the end of like a long stem and you swing in huge circle way up in the air. With one hand, you have, on either hand, you can control wings of your little glider to try to move up and move down. It's something that for smaller kids. By the way, there are two playgrounds as well. If a lot of these rides sound intense, it's true. They're more intense than Disney's rides tend to be. That's, I think, on purpose. Universal wants to get the kids who are done with princesses so that from like age 8 until they die, they'd rather be at Universal. That's the goal. But there are two playgrounds for kids too, where they can, you know, activity related things, where they can climb things or get wet or things like that. So there are some things for little kids. In Nintendo World, there's a very slow moving ride for toddlers, where if you see a colored egg, you're supposed to press a button in your ride and things light up. It's just very simple and vivid to catch their attention. So there are a few things for little kids to do, but the best things to do are definitely for grown-up tastes.
Now, you also need a place to sleep. So they've built a whole slew of new hotels, right? What are those like?
You know, Universal now owns and operates, well, Lowe's operates them, but it owns 11 hotels, which is getting up to the number that Disney has recently had too. So there are three. One is the real expensive one that is truly overlooking the park. Half of them are huge windows on one side, just take it all in. And especially at night, it's beautiful. But it's about $600 per room more than the other hotels. You'll pay $700 or $800 a night. That's called the Helios Grand. I don't think it's worth it. It's the only theme park hotel in Orlando that is abutting a park. So if you want that, that's the only place you can get it. The other two hotels are in the mid-200s. That's the Stella Nova and the Terra Luna. This, you know, they're just places that you can crash when you're on vacation. They're nice. They have big pools. They're not especially elaborate, but they're very close to the theme park. And this is interesting because this theme park area, it's about 750 acres all told, including the hotels, is in a completely different area of town from the main Universal Orlando. The main Universal Orlando area, which started in 1990, has the two theme parks and it has the water park and has a bunch of hotels. But Universal has claimed a brand new area of town that before now had never been built upon. It's about 2 miles away, takes about 10 or 15 minutes by a shuttle bus, which goes on an express lane for half the way that has been built just to get people between the two areas. That is quite close now to the convention center in Orlando. And Orlando is one of the biggest convention destinations in the world. So now Universal has a theme park that's pretty much within sight of the convention center, linked by an express bus system. And it's spreading out across town in order to conquer Disney.
Wow. Well, I know Disney World famously has International Drive right out front, where you can get a less expensive hotel than probably $250 a night, probably less than that, I think. Are there any budget lodgings in and around this new Universal park?
Well, International Drive is actually closer to Epic Universe than any of the other places we mentioned. It's like a half mile away. So International Drive, or at least the main section that you're talking about, you can get a room for a little over $100. And Universal, also another thing they've done to try to secure their position, is they, of all the theme parks that operate their own hotels or own their own hotels, Universal's are the least expensive per night. And they've done that intentionally to try to undercut their competitor. So if you're looking for a theme park hotel, or at least within a theme park grounds, the Universals are actually the cheapest to do that. But International Drive, but if you want a cheaper hotel than those, because you're going to pay a theme park markup, International Drive is a great area. And then you can walk around and eat all over International Drive too, at all sorts of chain restaurants. So the one downside, there are a few downsides besides the heat and other things at Epic Universe, is that there's really no place to walk and eat nearby. That will change in time because Universal doesn't own the land directly outside of it, but it'll take time for these things to be built. So for now, if you stay at these three hotels that have just been built for this, you will probably have to get in your car to have cheap things to eat.
Okay. What else should I be asking you? What else have we not covered here?
I know it's a question, I think, for some people of whether they want to do Disney or Universal now. That's a choice that you kind of didn't have to make because Universal had one or two parks. And now it has three, four if you do the waterslide park. And Disney has four dry theme parks and two waterslide parks, but usually only one of those waterslide parks is open at a time. So they're almost neck and neck. So people have to wonder, which do I want to do? I personally think that Disney's made some missteps and some changes in its parks. It's destroyed some things. It's about to destroy some things. It leans a little too much on its past. It's not building things that are technologically as progressive as what Universal is trying to do. So I feel like Universal now has the edge. I do know a lot of former Disney pass holders who feel the same way. If you have a little kids, yeah, Disney's speed and topic, the rides aren't too scary. Great for little kids, but there reaches a point when you want something a little more thrilling and a little bit more forward-looking. And I think that's where Universal is positioning itself, and more people will be choosing it. And it's going to change the landscape of Orlando. Disney swears it's not nervous. You know, at least they say that publicly at the investor meetings, but they should be, because Epic Universe is pretty cool. And Disney is not building things that are as detailed anymore. Generally, they build little areas that are, but you know, Epic Universe is the whole package.
Wow. Fascinating. And I should mention at this point that Jason is putting all of this stuff up on Fromers.com. So if you want to read his full reviews of the restaurants, of the theme parks, come visit us there. Don't go to frickin' AI because if you do, you're mostly going to get marketing materials.
Yeah, I'm even going to tell you like what are the best seats, and you know, I'm adding this stuff now in the next week or so. I'm going to tell you, you know, which side of the hotel you want, that kind of thing.
And can I ask you about London, or should we do that at another time? Because I'm actually speaking to Jason in London right now.
I've been here 24 hours. Today I went to the preview of the new Victoria and Albert East storehouse. The V&A Museum is, of course, one of the best museums in the entire world for arts and applied arts and decor and architecture. And they said at this opening that most museums can only display about 3% of what they have collected.
Wow.
And so the V&A East Storehouse, which is opened in East London as of May 31st, aims to correct that somewhat. There are more than 250,000 artifacts kind of stored in a giant warehouse, open air. And you can, before going, decide, I'd like to see that. I'd like to touch that. And you can order up to 5 items and they'll bring them to you in its study center and you can handle them and look at them and look at the seams. And it's incredible. Wow. So it's opening up their collections that would normally be locked away in a dark warehouse in a brand new novel architectural way. And it's also free, just like the V&A is. So we'll have an article on that up on Fromers.com already. In fact, it's already up.
Can I ask you, did you touch anything?
I had the opportunity to touch a Balenciaga gown and an Alexander McQueen. They had a few things out at this press preview. And I did get near them, but I didn't touch them.
Okay.
It's only been open, people have been booking Order an Object for a few weeks now. And already people are just love the fashion stuff. One woman came in and checked 5 different wedding dresses from history because she was planning her wedding. And she wanted to figure out what her wedding dress should be. So it's quite interesting to see the kinds of things that people want to get their hands on to look at. It's a novel concept.
Beyond fashion, they would have what? Flatware you could look at, or furniture, or wallpapers, or
all these things. Wow. I saw wallpaper at the preview. because the V&A has anything that someone has designed beautifully, it's probably part of the collection. And they've been collecting since 1852, and they collect anything from any time of any material. So, you know, they got millions of things that they can draw from. If there's something you want to research and you can find that it's available on the V&A website for the Order an Object program, you have to do it at least 2 weeks ahead of your visit, and you schedule the time of your visit. And after that, it's up to you, and it costs nothing.
If you're a design fan, is this a reason to go to London again?
Heck yes. I mean, design fans, it's like heaven. When do you get a chance to look at this stuff otherwise? Usually this stuff is reserved for scholars, people doing research, you know, historians who make scholarly appointments. You know, this is for everybody. It treats you with the same respect that, you would give someone who is researching this in a university or something. So pretty good.
If you don't have the foresight 2 weeks in advance to ask to see something specific and you just show up, you're still going to see very interesting things, right?
That's right. There's about 100 different specialty areas that are just, they pull out highlights and they rotate these all the time. So there's 100 different things that are just going to be there and explained. But also every single object you see, and there, again, there's hundreds of thousands, has a barcode next to it with an inventory code. And you can find out what it is on your smartphone with their free Wi-Fi. And so you can just explore that way. And anyone, and also they're going to roll out the stuff that is other people are looking at for order an object that day. So if they're done looking at it, curators will bring it out for everybody else because it's already off the shelf. We'll look at it. And when you first enter the museum, there's a big board that shows you what's on view that day and at what time.
Oh my goodness. Wow. It sounds like so much fun. As does Universal.
Completely different things. Like tourist attractions on two ends of the intellectual scale. One's like a thrill and one's, you know, mental gymnastics.
Well, you are a true Renaissance man, Jason, in that you bring both to light. Yeah. Well, thank you so, so much. And get some rest. I know you must be bleary from the jet lag. Thank you so much for appearing in the Frommer Travel Show, Jason.
It's great as always.
That's it for today's show. Thank you so much for listening. And to those who are traveling, may I wish you a hearty bon voyage.
I Luxury flights and hotels can be had for free. The world of points and miles sounds too good to be true, but it's actually real, but only if you know what you're doing.
On Frequent Miler on the Air, Greg and I, I'm Nick, discuss all the ways to earn points and miles and use them for outsized value.
Join us every Friday for our full episodes and every Tuesday for our quick, single-topic coffee break episodes.
See you there.